Hi, everyone, and welcome to ABC's Anesthesia. And today we have Dr. James back on the podcast. Now, in this episode, look, James and I, we were discussing a couple of things over the week, which was the fact that I think most of the time people agree, especially if you're in the same anesthesia department and maybe you've done a very similar training program. But then there are times when people disagree on things. And I don't know, it's one of those things where I think we think that there should be the ability to have really good, robust discussion about any points of disagreement, and it should be something that's really welcome. So we're actually having to think about all the ways we might disagree on things, and a common theme came out of it, which was, you know, the way we appreciate risk and how we manage risk and all the different elements from, you know, day to day, from minute to minute, moment to moment in our practice that, you know, the actions we take to do this. So welcome, James. I thought we'd just riff on a few different themes. How have you been this week?
Yeah, great. Look, thanks for having me on the podcast. Really appreciate your time, and yeah, good chance to have a discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, so one of the first things, I remember we were having this chat when we were just at dinner with a couple of mates, and you know, we were kind of reflecting on our practice, and I said, I auscultate every chest after intubation because I think that's really, really important. And I definitely find that this is not something that's routine anymore. I feel like most people don't even have a stethoscope. There's always one on the back of the machine. And to me, it's one of those things where I'm like, oh, have I become that guy who's practiced for this many years? And now is this something that's just not done or not necessary? But I think I firmly believe that I am in the right, and I'll get every trainee to wear a stethoscope and auscultate the lungs for a number of reasons. So maybe I should just go through my reasons for it and just take a counter to it. So I feel like when you intubate the lungs, that's the first time you will hear and auscultate the lungs to see what intubated lungs sound like on auscultation. It could be the first sign of bronchospasm. And I think that, you know, detecting that very quickly is advantageous. And, you know, you won't always see this in any study, but, you know, if you detect it at 1 second versus 30 seconds, I feel like that will be an incredibly far, you know, very, you know, a lot better for the patient. I also think that, you know, hypoxemia is probably one of the, one of two very common problems that you have to solve in general anesthetic. And the fact that you already know what the normal lungs intubated sounds like means you have a baseline to then go by. So, you know, if hypoxemia happens again, you'll go, oh, you know, I know what the lungs were already quiet. I'm not going to mistake that for a pneumothorax or something, or, oh, those coarse crackles were already there, or that noise was already there. And, you know, you can probably, I'm hoping you can differentiate the problems of hypoxemia a lot faster. But yep, I know that that's not what everyone does. People intubate their lungs, and everything seems to go fine, but I feel like we can do a lot, like a little bit better potentially by doing so.
Yeah, I mean, I think those are pretty common discussion points and arguments about how and why we should, you know, auscultate the chest. So I think dysgeusia first. disclosure first, I almost never listen to the chest. And that's not to say I don't, but I almost never. And I think perhaps from that point, what I can say is I actually do agree with a lot of what you said. Ooh. So I think...
So why don't you? So that's a good place to start. So clearly we have a difference in practice.
Yeah, let's start with where we agree, right? So I think where we agree is that hypoxemia is potentially a problem with anesthesia. And it is something that we deal with not infrequently. So I think we agree with that. Where I think you and I differ is where we think the role of auscultation plays in the diagnosis and management of that. And I think much of our decisions are probably based around experience rather than evidence, because as you mentioned, the evidence is going to be scant on something like this. It's a very difficult thing to study because the operator has a great deal of, the operator is very important in deciding whether or not a particular intervention, which is very subtle and very user-dependent, then plays a role in managing a problem which has got multiple causes like hypoxemia. Now, I'm not saying that if you can immediately auscultate and detect a difference, that's not helpful. I certainly used to do that. And at the time, I thought it was helpful. So my experience, which I think is different from yours, which is probably where this comes from, is that in the times that I have reflected on where I have auscultated the chest, the auscultation comes as a secondary intervention. And the reason for that is that I don't detect bronchospasm or pneumothorax by auscultating. So it is not a primary intervention or a primary diagnostic mechanism for me. And so if it isn't that, then the question becomes, well, if I already have a pre-test probability that's high, what does this intervention add? So what I guess I'm trying to say is that I don't think that the intervention in and of itself warrants the
extra step.
Well, it doesn't warrant universal application, because I think that the pre-test, post-test probability change from auscultation is generally lower than other interventions. And the other problem with listening to everyone is that for me, I think if I listen to everyone, the rate of false positives is high enough in my experience that I don't think, without having significant pretest probability, the intervention itself is functional, as in. And I think that there is some evidence about auscultation and its clinical applicability, but it's not specific to anesthesia. So I don't know how well I can apply that particular piece of information.
That actually makes a lot of sense. I'm actually really glad we had this chat. I'm going to steel man your argument just to kind of solidify in my head. So to steel man your argument, kind of to clarify what you're saying, let's take the example of bronchospasm. So you've got a patient, you're intubating, maybe they're a smoker, maybe they're asthmatic, and you then get high pressures. You're like, well, I actually don't need to auscultate that to detect whether it's going to be bronchospasm. I could go straight in and give Ventolin, and that has minimal problems for this patient. And, it would have all the benefits, and I'll probably be correct in my diagnosis or something like that. And the extra step of auscultating may not actually, even if that auscultation didn't give me wheeze, I would probably still give Ventolin. So that's one aspect. And the other aspect, if I'm listening to every single chest, then I might detect false positives or, wheeze where there isn't actually wheeze or bronchospasm, meaning I might start treating with Ventolin for, another reason. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, broadly speaking, the only point I would add to that is that listening to every single person's chest is not, is actually quite effortful, in that it takes time and cognitive load. It's not so much the time, it's more the cognitive load. What do I do with this piece of information, particularly if it's not normal? And there are lots and lots of abnormal examinations when we listen to people with anesthesia. Juice breath sounds is basically part of the course when I used to do this. Particularly in patients who have some pre-existing abnormal pathology. So I think that's essentially it. I think you've encapsulated my argument pretty well.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I can now think back to, when you first said, oh, it's our experiences that have shaped the way we practice. This is absolutely correct. I mean, I remember one of my very first experiences as a, resident after hours, my fellow was there we had a severe bronchospasm, couldn't get the SATs above 79. And I thought that, now that I reflect on it, I thought we detected it late, a little bit late. I think the management was fantastic, but it was so severe and I've never seen anything like that. But that's a moment in time. And then I had another moment where one of my bosses, who's very rigid in his structure, went, if you're not listening to the lungs, Lahiru, you're not doing a good job, or something along the lines of that. And so I can absolutely see how these two things have, absolutely framed the way that I practice. Hey, but how about the other? I guess my counter to those points. I actually totally accept your points there. You know, like when we have an abnormal ECG, we always look for the pre-op ECG. So this is probably one of those examples where I'm like, okay, I need to hear the lungs intubated, because let's say you take the most complicated case where maybe they've got lung disease and they've got chest trauma and they've got some other heart failure thing and asthma. So you've got many potential differentials for this, then I can kind of see what the normal state is. And then any hypoxemia from after that, I can now compare it as another point of evidence. So, and the time it takes me, I always say this, that once to my trainees, when you get good at this, you put the tube in, first ventilation is for fogging, next one is for auscultate the stomach, third and fourth are to auscultate each axilla. And then once you've done that, then the delay that happened with sidearm CO2 sampling, then you've confirmed that. So you've actually not wasted any time, though it is potentially cognitively kind of intensive. So I think those are my two extra things that I go in the most complex cases. I think I would care about this a lot more.
So let me see if I've understood you correctly. What you're saying is that, you know, in difficult cases, particularly difficult cases, having that understanding of where the patient is prior to any problems happening allows you to add to your pretest probability. And the auscultation is definitely useful in that setting. Is that, have I understood that correctly?
Yeah, I will do it for all cases because it saves time. And in the most complex cases, I now have an extra data point, like an ECG comparison, like an echo comparison.
Yeah, so in low risk cases, you do it because it's part of your care and it's not really going to add any extra time onto it. That's fair. But in high risk cases, what you're saying is it gives you an extra data point to assess the patient's overall pretest probability when something goes wrong. Is that correct?
That's fair.
So I actually think that's actually very sensible. And in fact, I would go so far as to say I probably should do that more.
Yeah.
So remember how I said I don't always, but I do sometimes?
Yep.
And in fact, I do. So if I think a patient has abnormal lungs that are likely to be problematic during my management of anesthesia, I will listen to their chest. So I actually do carry a stethoscope. I just don't use it very often. The number of patients we see in our practice that have significant lung problems that I'm then intervening on that are likely to cause problems, it's quite low. So an example of where I would do that would be like PEDS ENT, where kids come in with problems and you're like, are they okay? I think that's a really great scenario where listening to the chest adds to the whole picture of whether this is an evolving lower respiratory tract infection or an upper respiratory. So I think that's a perfect context in which we do that. So actually, I do agree on that front. For everyone, that's actually a really interesting point too. And I see where you're coming from with that, with this, like, if you build this into your process, it then doesn't become as difficult to do it for the times that you do it. And I actually think that's quite important, particularly as a trainee. So as a trainee, part of what you're doing is getting the outcomes that you want. But also part of what you're doing is learning how to do things in a systematic process way. And in fact, I think that advice for do this to everyone as a trainee is super useful. So perhaps maybe my initial point of, well, I don't really do it, that loses the nuance of this particular conversation of, well, maybe as a trainee or someone who's not feeling confident with their kind of pretest probability assessments, it is really valuable to do that.
We come around kind of full circle in a way that, the subtlety. So we practice differently, but yeah. I can totally agree. I think we both practice very similarly at the higher risk end of things, or the complex end of things. And then even where we differ, there's probably a lot of build up to that difference where, you've already got the skills in auscultation.
Yeah.
And then that's good.
And I just haven't continued it. So like I said, when I was a trainee, I definitely would auscultate everyone's chest. And I did for a long time, even after I became a consultant. And so I don't anymore because I found that my pretest screening for patients who likely to have problems and then my process for managing that is so systematized and, efficient that I don't know that doing it for everyone else adds to it. And as I said, for me, seeing everyone and listening to their chest just adds 30 seconds onto my way of managing things.
Yeah.
So and the trainee shouldn't do that. But I think that if you get to the point where you are thinking about it, then perhaps, it's worthwhile considering whether or not it is adding to your thing. And perhaps I think your way of, I'll keep doing it, if your process includes it, then that's good enough. I think that's perfectly fine. And certainly for high patients, I think that's a great idea.
Hey, so the next potential point of contention is, like when you put a drip in, sometimes it doesn't go in the first time. You try to push off and then it doesn't quite work and you might have an effort of trying salvages. I know that in pediatric veins, which are extremely kind of, you know, elastic and do heal very well, that's something I probably would do with a lot of caution. But in adults, I'm like, you know what? I just never salvage a drip. If I miss it on that first pass, I will try again and, you know, put pressure on it, try it at a different site. And my thoughts on that is that the risk, you know, in our world, in the anesthetic world, the risk of a drip being tissued and us not discovering that it's tissued and the drugs that we give that need to act very rapidly to prevent bad things happening is so, you know, so important that I just cannot accept that extra risk. So I will never accept a salvage drip. And it's always a question that I'll ask my trainees, hey, if it looked like it took a little bit longer for them to put a drip in, like, hey, did you salvage that? Or you know, even a ward drip, I'm not too confident about them. And they constantly have issues. Even just the other day, I had a ward drip, which, you know, the bung just wasn't put on properly. And I had propofol dripping down. And I was like, oh, you know, it was just one of those moments where our drip is so important. And the fact that it works is so important that if I don't do it, it's very hard for me to trust it. But what are your thoughts on that? Do we have much disagreement with salvaging drips?
I think if I understood you correctly, what you're saying is that if the drip fails, then it's a really big problem.
Yeah.
And it's just not worth it when putting in a drip is generally pretty easy.
Absolutely. And to extend that, I think salvaging drips in other contexts, like on the ward, you know, salvage a drip, most of the time you're running fluids, maybe some antibiotics, maybe some pain relief. This in the tissue is very forgivable. It doesn't cause incredible harm, but our drugs cause incredible harm if it's tissue on multiple points, the actual tissue site, but also the fact that the medication isn't going into the patient in the right way.
So I think, where I disagree with you on that one is actually context. So actually two things. Context is important. It depends on what's happening. If we were to narrow it down to elective patients having surgery where we've got a drip, then I do agree there's no point trying to salvage basically any drips. Mm-hmm. I'm probably more permissive though, because I would say that for most patients, it's actually not that disastrous to lose an IV. And that probably plays a little bit into how I give my anesthetics. Mm-hmm. So the way I give my anesthetics is generally, and we can talk about this later, but is generally a volatile-based anesthetic as well, in addition to whatever intravenous agents that we're giving. So if I lose my drip, it's not the end of the world. I make very rare interventions on an IV generally throughout most cases. Rare, as in less than once an hour. And I'm monitoring almost everything very closely. And there are points of failure in anesthetic delivery, IV anesthetic delivery, that are not related to the drip itself. I do agree that the drips failing has been a common experience of mine. And also all around. And certainly every single anesthetic awareness that I have ever seen or heard of has related to some form of IV failure. I don't think I've ever seen one which is related to like volatile delivery failure. It's possible and I know it exists. I've personally never seen that in the years that I've been doing.
I agree, I've only heard one happen, and that was where someone forgot to turn on the volatile.
Oh, that's true. No, so that has happened, I think, in particularly in sort of induction phase. I think it is possible that you could do that. So yes, that is definitely a thing. But yeah,
just to clarify then, you know, and maybe I agree with most of that, but you know, when if you have a patient who's hypertensive, your intravenous intervention is incredibly important. So the vasopressor getting in or...
Yeah.
And does it change what you're saying when your arms are tucked in to the side?
But that's not your standard ASA1 elective patient. No. So those patients, you know, again, context is key here, right? So who do you work on? What's your practice like? And what kind of patients are you delivering this to? You know, does a cesarean section need better IV access than an endoscopy? 100%. So would I be very, very careful with cesarean section where I'm giving a liter or two of fluid? Yeah, definitely. In fact, I almost always put a 16-gauge cannula in all my cesarean sections for that reason, because the unpredictability of those patients require you to have more interventions. But like for a general case where I'm, like I said, making about one intervention per hour, that's not that different from an ICU, not that different from the ward, potentially. It's not that big a deal. So I would be okay with salvaging IVs in those patients, although I generally think that if you have a concern, just put a new one in. So context, I think, is really, really important. And where I differ is I think I'm much more contextual in how I approach that. So I don't really have a, I always salvage drips, and no, I don't. And you've alluded to it as well. In pediatrics, I would almost always consider salvaging a drip. And I guess that touches into, do you transfix vessels? That's a pretty recognized technique of using IVs and intra-arterial lines, particularly transfixion. So I think, I think transfixion for arterial lines certainly works.
Absolutely.
But it makes it more likely that your arterial line will fail. So, you know, should you accept a transfixed arterial line? Most people probably would say yes if it was working okay, because you've got some two radial arteries. So it's the same. So if you don't have very good IV access, if it's a renal patient who you really just want to use for a short period of time, yeah, I think it's fine. But yeah, so I think I broadly agree with your idea that yes, it probably isn't worth it when your risk of failing is high. But if your risk of failing is not that high, then I think it's okay. And the other thing is, perhaps where I disagree with you, is I don't think the risk of failing is as high as what you might be stating all the time. So I think that for most ASA1 patients, we're giving sort of a standard anesthetic to, and that's the majority of our patients, then it's not that high. Mm-hmm. And even if you extravasate a decent volume of whatever drug, usually it's pretty benign. I mean, there's a good amount of academic literature on this, again, not randomized in any way, but observational studies that suggest that extravasation of anesthetic agents is mostly pretty benign. Mm. So even if you extravasate norepinephrine or noradrenaline, it's not that bad. Mm. You just watch it. Probably the biggest problem is things like dextrose and volume and highly osmotic things. Mm. But we give those things so rarely that I think if you were giving those things, then yeah, definitely. So again, it's a bit more of a subtle decision. And again, this comes from, our pool of experience of what does the overall picture look like before we make a decision? And personally, I like to take that approach as, what is the overall picture if this drip were to fail? And I guess, in some ways that's a bit more of a subtle decision for me. So in most times where my overall risk, I think, of drips failing is pretty low, I don't really worry too much about it. But if, for example, it's a sick patient getting a big operation where I'm doing lots of fluids, giving really potent vasoactive agents or potentially, osmotic fluids, then yeah, I would consider whether or not I would even touch that drip, particularly if it's a drip that I haven't put in. Like you said, it's like a emergency case. But often in those cases, I find that you don't have cognitive loading. You're so cognitively overloaded anyway that it's very hard to be like, oh, what am I going to do with the drip? So I think if you have the time and you have the thought and the space and you think it is high risk, then that's a great time to be like, nope, not accepting it.
Okay, I can definitely see where we deviate on that. Even the ASA1 patient, I'm thinking, you're right. Bad things are not happening with any increased frequency, but the thought of something occurring, like let's say they get an anaphylaxis, this is a once every 5 to 10 year event for us, maybe. And then mix that with the salvage drip failure incidents. Again, very rare. But if those two do happen, that probably is closer to death or, some bad mortality. And that's, like you said before, for the ease of the intervention, that's where I can't accept that one, that risk. So I will always.
A separate and more interesting discussion, I think. So you're saying that the potential for a rare but serious complication to occur without an IV, with an IV that's not functional, is really bad, and it can potentially cause problems. I would say I would agree with that. Mostly agree with that. I think that's pretty sensible. The problem happens when you then apply this same intervention to patients that are low risk, because an IV, even though it's low risk, is not zero. Mm. And the problem is very low risk multiplied over thousands of patients becomes very quantitatively high.
Yeah.
I think that that's actually quite an unreasonable thing to subject everyone to for that 1,000 risk of anaphylaxis to antibiotics or whatever. And then the problem is that then you got a second thing, which is like, oh, then I don't have an IV in that patient.
Yeah.
So like...
Actually, just
how many patients are you harming to save that one patient in maybe 10,000, 100,000 that has an anaphylaxis with an unfunctional IV?
That's such a good point, right? So imagine the case where someone who's an ASA1 gets an anaphylaxis and someone salvaged a drip, put it in, it was working fine, and then anaphylaxis happens, and now the drip fails when you really need it, and patient has a bad outcome. From the chain of events, it would feel very much like it was Denise's fault there. In the environment where you could assign some level of responsibility, you know, that would feel like the anaesthetist's responsibility that ended. Whereas to not salvage a drip, and which might mean, you know, say drip plus one every now and again, multiply that over thousands of cases, and maybe the drip has an incidence of whatever, you know, thing, some nerve damage, an infection post or whatever, that feels, maybe nerve damage feels very much directly like the anaesthetist's problem or the anaesthetist's fault. But for an infection later on, that feels a lot less like it. But, you know, I can see where my brain's going to these two scenarios.
Yeah, well, I guess what you're trying to say is that you feel like you're more responsible when it seems like the complication happens in your care.
That's not holistic, is it?
Well, yeah. So my perspective is that it doesn't matter when the complication happens. If I was part of that intervention, then it is my responsibility. Whether I know about it or not, like directly, doesn't change the fact that it's my responsibility. But I think that's different. Like, people have different views of whether or not complications that occur outside of your window of care are your responsibility. And I just think that personally, if I've intervened, it doesn't actually matter when the complications happens. It's still my responsibility. Now, I may not be the one dealing with it. I may not be the one responsible for caring for that patient. For example, you know, if I have a neuroaxial complication 6 months down the track and the neurosurgeon has to go, you know, do whatever, which has happened to me before, like, that's still my responsibility. And so, yeah, I kind of think that way about IVs as well, which again is a fairly, I think, maybe a bit more of an extreme example of like, well, we do thousands of IVs over the course of a year. You know, how many of those are we going to take responsibility for? Well, I think some responsibility. I take some responsibility for some of those. So I try not to intervene where I can. But I can see how people will be like, well, it's not my problem. You know, many other things could happen. Mm-hmm. And I take that same approach to if it was anaphylaxis. And one of the many things that happen if a patient has a really bad outcome due to anaphylaxis or some rare complication of anesthesia, that if it's the IV that's tissued, well, yes, that is my portion of responsibility for that. But there's also all these other things that have had to have gone wrong for this patient to then suffer a bad outcome. So I kind of feel like if that does happen, I will have some responsibility for that part. But there's also all this other stuff that happens. So I think that's where I do.
No, I think that was a good discussion about that. I want to move on to one of the anesthetics I had a look at. And again, this anesthetic was, quite different to my standard anesthetic. I think it was a laparoscopic gynae operation. I think you ran, propofol, Teva, propofol rather, and volatile, as well as magnesium, lignocaine, ketamine, and some level of fentanyl, some amount of fentanyl. And I think this goes towards your, I guess, principles of opioid reduction in as best as you can for patients. And I wanted to ask you about that. What's tell me about how that came about, why you think opioids are so dangerous, and your method of doing, all these extra multimodal techniques to try and minimize that, how you perceive it's worthwhile.
Yeah, I think it's a really nice flow on discussion, actually. It is about what I think I take responsibility for. And you're right, it is a particularly, the anesthetic is very different for most people because I take a particular view that the dispensing of opioids in the perioperative period is my responsibility. And therefore, and it's not just my responsibility over one patient, it's my responsibility over the community. Because like one of the largest sources of opioids in the community is around surgery. So if I'm careful and thoughtful about how I prescribe opioids, then perhaps there'll be flow-on effects for the community that are positive. And I think there's lots and lots of evidence now internationally about opioids being very dangerous in the community. And this is not in anesthesia. This is in the post-operative and generally chronic pain settings. But we know that all anesthesia has a chance, basically any surgery has a chance of persistent post-operative pain, which essentially is just a spectrum of chronic pain. I guess in some ways I have this sort of belief that we live in a kind of, nosogenic kind of environment where people are particularly sensitized to painful stimuli. So, and that's sort of a separate discussion, but essentially I worry that if I'm not the one gatekeeping opioid prescription in the perioperative setting, who am I leaving to do that? Who is that? That's going to be our surgical colleagues who have a different set of incentives potentially to us. And I'm not talking about monetary, I'm just talking about how they look after patients, but also much less experience and pharmacological knowledge and use of these opioids, and they certainly don't have the sort of acute understanding of how these drugs work. That's not to say all surgeons, but they just don't get trained in the same way. So because of that,
their advantage is that they know, I suspect that they know better than us the opioid or the pain levels post-op that we don't see. But
yeah. Yes, but in Australia, at least, they're incentivized in giving more. That's the problem.
As in, so to stop the patient having to come back and the difficulty of getting a new prescription, and any patient in pain is bad, therefore they'll get a bad reputation as a surgeon, maybe.
So they don't see the long-term sequelae. Surgeons follow patients for 6 months for benign problems, right? Which, you know, like, for example, a great example is a cesarean section. Like, a gynecologist is not seeing a patient 6 months later if they've got pain. They've discharged the patient. So this is my thing. It's like, surgeons have a set of incentives to make sure the patients are well, but their sort of responsibility for the patient, in Australia at least, tends to end at a certain time. And then they kind of go to your local doctor and sort that out. And the problem is that our colleagues in the sort of, you know, GP practice, they're not as well equipped to deal with this. And so any small thing that we can do globally to try and reduce the burden of opioids to the community, and particularly, I mean, in the outpatient setting, I think that's beneficial.
Once you chart the post-op meds on the EMR, do you put a note for the resident to, you know, this is what they should go home on, or, you know, how do you interact?
That's a really interesting question. I would like to. But we don't have a system in place to do that. I would really prefer that we have a system in place where the residents are, you know, basically given a strict instruction. So in private, I do. So in private, when I'm operating on my own, I'm like, you start your opioid this day and you end it this day. And then I have a close liaison with my surgeons. It's just like, okay, what do you do? Now, I don't do particularly big operations in private, but I do painful operations in private. So tonsils are quite painful. And so they require a decent amount of opioids. But most surgeons would want their patients to be comfortable. They don't think in 6 months' time, if the patient has chronic pain, for example. So at least they sort of, it's less on their radar, I should say.
So your hypothesis is by giving the combination lignocaine, magnesium, ketamine, some opioids, that and other multimodal analgesia, that overall, over many thousands of cases, is going to decrease opioids in the future.
I think so. And I think we don't have great evidence on that because it's hard to follow patients for that period of time. There is some evidence, though. And perhaps a lot of it comes from sort of prescribing habits in areas where they change their opioid prescribing and their opioid prescribing regimens. And so I think Michigan's a state in the US, which you know, has done some of that work, and they've reduced some of their opioid dependency and their sort of post-operative pain with some of that work. It's not great data because it's, you know, these are long-term sort of things. But certainly, I think, you know, when I was working in the US, that was definitely much more front of mind for the clinicians because of the depths of the opioid epidemic that they had. Like I said, they probably live in a more kind of chronic pain generating society than we do. But that doesn't mean we don't have a responsibility. And I think I take that more as this is our responsibility, and therefore I'm going to do everything I can to manage that. Now, the benefit's probably going to be smaller in a place like Australia where we work. But certainly in amongst our, you know, population, you know, in the western suburbs of Melbourne, I think there's benefit there. If I was working, say, in like, I don't know, a different place where maybe chronic pain is not so difficult, maybe it would be different. But I think the risks of what I do are pretty low. And I think the anesthetic that I run are pretty low risk overall for the potential opioid reduction over the population.
And so just to clarify, so your lignocaine formula would be something like a milligram per kilogram at the start, and then a milligram per kilogram per hour.
Yep.
And that's well within kind of maximum doses, so that is safe. Magnesium, 2 gram loading, 1 gram per hour?
I tend to give about 6 milligrams per kilogram per hour plus a 6 milligram per kilogram load, which is basically on the very, very low end of what is therapeutic. So there's different doses of magnesium, but that's a very, very low dose of magnesium.
So 6 milligrams per kilogram per hour for this. Okay, you're good. And again, that's you don't try to increase that. So and ketamine, roughly?
0.2 milligrams.
I'll say it again.
0.2 milligrams per kilogram per hour.
No bolus?
I usually give them 0.2 milligram bolus.
Okay, good. And then any extra signs of the patient's in pain, you top up with fentanyl.
Yeah. So what I try and do is I try and use the sort of analgesic ladder strategy, which is like I want to have their baseline analgesia covered. And I think with that mix of medications, you cover most people's baseline analgesia for the perioperative period. You might miss the bit at the end, but the multimodal strategy and the sort of doses and the synergism basically give most people plenty of analgesia. And there are patients who wake up who, in fact, most patients wake up and like, I have a bit of pain. And that's okay. What I do is I still use fentanyl packet protocol. And I'm okay with that. Because the problem is that many of those drugs, people aren't familiar with it outside of the operating room. And really, anesthetists mostly don't use those drugs. So using the combination of the drugs, I'm very comfortable with, but I know that other people aren't. So I'm very happy to use the system that we have in place for giving opioids in the perioperative period. But what I just want to do is reduce what I can reduce. What's in my control is what happens in the operating room. And so I want to minimize that as much as possible. But I found that in my experience of using this for sort of nearly 6 years or so, that actually the total opioid dosing for the first 24 hours is quite a lot lower now. And I think that that might tie into the fact that with opioids, we probably get a high degree of opioid-induced acute tolerance or opioid-induced hyperalgesia that we don't recognize, because if we use opioids all the time, we have this kind of calibrated, this is how much opioid we need. Mm. And so we just kind of give what we need. And we don't account for the fact that maybe they didn't need that at all before we gave the morphine. And so I found that, you know, particularly in the PACU setting, I'm very rarely giving patients for any operation more than 100 of fentanyl, which would be for Australia quite like unusual.
Have you seen, have you tracked your patients over a period of time? Like, is this a case series that you've done or?
So I would love to say that I have, but the fact is I haven't, because I haven't got the data collection. It's very difficult to do this in Australia because our data is so all over the place.
Yeah.
I would like to. So that's probably the next project that I'm going to do is probably what I use. And in fact, in the US, I tracked it for a bit and it was fine. It was in line with everybody else who was doing the same sort of thing. Mm. So they do track other countries. And so this is where I got my data from. But and I have changed things a little bit. So I would like to see what my changes have done.
Mm. And this makes a lot of sense. And I'll tell you where I come from. So I don't traditionally use lignocaine or magnesium. I have a reasonably low threshold of using ketamine. And from my point of view, you know, when a patient's in pain and I can keep increasing the opioids to tackle the pain problem, it makes it, you know, I know my immediate problems with pain are going to be respiratory depression and sedation, and I can kind of sort those problems out. Whereas when I think of increasing, you know, local anesthetic or magnesium, I'm looking at a whole range of different problems that complicate the picture of things going wrong postoperatively. I like your method that, you know, you just use a standard dose up to its reasonable level, and you're not trying to chase analgesia by increasing lignocaine or magnesium, and you still save opioids. So that makes a lot of sense to me, and I'd be extremely, receptive to actually doing that myself now. What's your lap collie, would you be running this regime of medications? How much fentanyl would you give for a 2-hour lap collie, let's say?
No more than 100.
No more than 100. Okay. So I routinely give about 200 to 300 for a 2-hour lap collie. Yep.
I presume you'd give some paracetamol and
All the other usual stuff. Yep.
I don't bother with that anymore, because I think the reduction of those drugs of your total opioid dosing is insignificant compared to all the other things that I'm using. I think if the patient was at high risk of postoperative pain, I would give them, but in general, I don't think the reduction.
So you don't give anti-inflammatories like paracoxib? No.
I give it to them orally. If they're having oral intake, they can have it immediately post-op.
Okay, so they'll get it.
Yes. I write it up for them in the post-op setting, but I don't give it in theater anymore.
Okay. And what is the, which cases don't you? So don't you do this mixture of lignocaine, magnesium, ketamine? Is it the hysteroscopy, smaller stuff, or do you just give this for everybody?
Good question. So it's actually more just a practical thing at that point in time. Yeah. Again, sort of analgesic bladder, right? So how painful is this operation? So basically I use everything if it's going to be a painful operation. Basically anything more than a sort of, laparoscopy, I would deem to be a painful operation. Hmm. And also time, right? So if it's a short operation, like a half hour operation, it's kind of annoying to drop all this sort of stuff when most of the time you can just get boluses of these medications and it'll do the same thing. So I kind of go, well, if the required opioid dosing is going to be generally quite low, like less than 100, 150, I probably don't bother giving all of these, definitely as an infusion. But, I give them boluses. So again, for tonsils, I'll often give some magnesium So that's a short operation. Patients are not painful, but it's kind of annoying to set up this infusion. And also ketamine's not great in tonsils because it makes the patients dribble a lot, make their blood pressure a bit high sometimes. So I don't do that. But I would give them some dexmedetomidine, just a little bolus of dexmedetomidine or a little bolus of magnesium. Usually with my surgeons, they tend to put local for over the sort of tonsil bed. So I don't use local in that setting.
I would love to see.
I'm very liberal with giving magnesium and dexmedetomidine. I think it's really good. And the problem is, I think it's hard to make sure you don't give too much. So I just really try not to give too much of dexmedetomidine particularly. Because as you said, it then causes all these other problems if you give too much. And so I try and cap the dose of that at less than 0.5 per kilo. Doses. And again, the only reason for that is that because dexmedetomidine works differently, patients look different when they've had a lot of dexmedetomidine. And so if you're expecting a patient to look a certain way, like PACU nurses are trained and our PACU protocols are trained for, and they don't look like that, they get very confused and then they don't really know what to do. And that's not to say that, you know, like they should know what to do because it's different. Like I know not everyone does that. So I'm very comfortable with saying, well, you just use our normal protocols for fentanyl to address that. But what I'm trying to do is just reduce the dose of fentanyl that we're using. The aim is not to get rid of it because I think that's difficult to prove that it's A, possible, and B, beneficial.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I think that was really helpful. I'd love to, just getting the ethics approval to track your lap collies potentially versus mine or your, say a reasonably standard operation in a non-chronic pain patient. It'd be really great to see some, even for your own comparison, your own data, but I'd love to see my data on opioid usage and maybe we can
consult. Yeah, not from just opioid usage, it comes from like side effect monitoring. So like vomiting rates, length of stay and recovery, that sort of stuff is all very important to patient experience and patient's sort of holistic care. And like I said, in the US, we had all this data that was collected through the care of the patient. So we would send out, audit numbers for everyone every for the cases that are standardized, so ERAS kind of cases that they would have. So we're definitely working towards that. I think we will have that in the next few years, but it's just a matter of once we get our information systems up to scratch and we have our audit tools built, then we should be able to do that. So yes, I would like to do that. And I think that if you were doing that as part of an audit, you probably have something like a standing ethics proposal for that. Ongoing audits, and it's questionable whether I even actually would even need an audit for that, something like that.
But ethics for an audit?
Yeah, well, you're just doing quality. You're just making sure that you're delivering quality care. So, it's, but there probably will need to be some sort of structure around it. And so, I think we should do that, and I think we are going to continue to work towards that. And that's always been the vision for our digital health systems.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, James. So we've actually probably come up to almost our time. I think that was just a really useful session. It was so good to have some level of discussion about different styles of anesthetics. Like your anesthetic just looks very different to mine, but I think I broadly agree with everything you said, and I might actually even start doing certain things to just see what it is like to run more infusions, even though it does seem like I've taken up a whole bunch of syringe drivers to do it. It might be really beneficial. Yeah.
As a nice side to that, over time, I basically just put them all into one syringe, which they're all compatible. So problems with that. And so I just run at a fixed rate. And so that makes it easy. I just use two syringe drivers, one for my propofol and one for my other infusions.
Can you tell me the makeup of your, I assume it's a lignocaine, magnesium, ketamine.
And dexmedetomidine.
In one, what's your formula?
So the final concentrations of all of them, I use lignocaine 1% as the base solution. I add in a 10 millimole or 2.47 gram magnesium vial. So I have a total volume of 40 mils from that. And then I add in 0.8 mils of ketamine with our solution, which is 80 milligrams of ketamine. So it ends up being 0.2 milligrams, 2 milligrams per mil of ketamine. And I add in 40 micrograms of dexmedetomidine, so 0.4 mils of the 100 mic per mil solution. And you end up with 1 mic per mil of dexmedetomidine. And I run that whole solution at 0.1 mils per kilo per hour. And that ends up giving you the correct doses, as I said before, of all those agents. Your lignocaine is slightly below 1 milligram per kilogram per hour, but it's close enough that I think that it would be reasonable.
Hey, James, so could you send that formula, just text it to me. I'll just put it in the chat. In the story notes, just for people and for my own interests. That sounds
good. Other people put fentanyl in that syringe. So people also then put fentanyl on top of that. I think you can. You could also potentially put muscle relaxant in there if you really wanted to, but I think that those drugs come with some problems, and I'm okay with, you know, occasionally having to top up some fentanyl and top up some, you know, muscle relaxant. So I don't routinely do those things, I know that people do that, so I don't tend to do that. I'll send it to you, and then we can you can post it in your comments. Yeah, it's a pretty sort of consistent solution now, and I. As needed. So if a patient has a contraindication to any of them, I'll omit them, but I pretty rarely omit anything. If I'm running it, I'm running it.
That's great. Hey, thanks, James. So we covered quite a few things. Auscultation. We covered salving the drips and the risk benefit around that. And also your very extreme multimodal analgesia opioid reduction strategy, which it sounds really cool.
Yeah, but like I said, I think that's just a perspective difference. I don't really expect other people to see it the same way because I think it depends on your experience as to what you think it falls under your responsibility and just your general view on what your role as a anesthetic provider is. It's as much a personality and an experience thing than it is a science thing. There's a science behind it, and I think the science is reasonably well thought out, but also a lot of it lacks evidence because we don't, you know, again, if you don't have the perspective that you need to review all these things, and many of these things are about long-term risks and benefits, it's very hard to get good scientific evidence to back up what you do. So I'm not militant about it, but I do think that for my experience, that's what works best.
Yeah, sounds good. Hey, James, thanks so much for being on. So everyone, share with anyone who might be interested. There's been ABC's Anesthesia, and you'll be able to see it on YouTube or as a podcast. We'll see you again next time. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Lahiru. That's been great.
Cheers.